Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge. Tom is with Dee Dee today. They're going to be going through some medical stuff, so our hearts are with them. We've got Joe C. Broadcasting in. And so we're going to be talking about, did you say emotional sobriety as it pertains to existentialism? Or could you elaborate a little bit on what you...
Alan, maybe you at some point read some of Ernest Becker's work, Denial of Death and Escape from Evil. It was a Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that that was his book.
Yeah, Cultural Anthropologist. And
that was a great book, that Denial yeah. of Death. But that was a brilliant, I read that book in college in a psychology course.
I bet you did. The basic idea is humans are unique in that we know about our own mortality. Birds and horses and dogs just go along their life living in the moment, not thinking about the fact that one day I will die. And who will be, how will I be remembered? What can I do to create something I can leave behind that offers me immortality? And the social psychologists who have picked up on Ernest Becker's work have formed something called terror management theory. There's an Ernest Becker Foundation, and you can look at the work of Tom Pazinski and Jeff Greenberg and Sheldon Solomon, who I've talked to a few times about their work. And he's a funny guy. I quote him in Beyond Belief, Agnostic Musings. And he talks about how it's kind of hard to deal with the fact that we're just a meat sack. And, 50 years after we're gone, we won't be any more significant than a potato or a June bug, right? And people have a hard time coping with that. And it can lead to addiction, and it can lead to, a mad quest for immortality, building religions, inventions, writing songs. Sheldon Solomon recently in a podcast, he talked about how they really spent all of their body of work on the downside to terror management theory, how we have to build these self-esteem building constructs, you know, be it religious or nationhood or, an extended family that make us feel good and make us feel like we are building something that will last. And the danger when, one nation, has a different worldview than another nation, or one religion has a different, and history's full of that, right? And 9/11, the Crusades, all of this sort of thing is one worldview versus another worldview. And he said that there's a positive side to it too, and that is that we can embrace the fact that now is all we have, that the future isn't guaranteed, and live in awe, live in humility, accepting our limitations, and living in gratitude. Three simple things that are all about emotional sobriety. Awe about the wonder of our life and the mystery. We don't have all the answers. That's awe-inspiring. And that can be either secular or religious. You need to have also humility. And that isn't self-effacing. That's knowing that we are significant in a small way. We're part of a whole. We are the whole universe. We are stardust. We will last forever, just not in our conscious state. Our time on Earth is limited, and today is all we have. That's that kind of humility, and also gratitude. Just to really, and for all the time we spend looking at the existential threats in our life, paying attention to the news, can we spend an equal amount of time focusing and meditating on what gives us awe? Bill Shaberg talks about find the places in the your world that bring you closer to spirituality and go there often. Right. Do the practices, go to the places, spend the time at least as much as we spend going through our newsreel. you know, and to keep some sort of balance and sanity in ourselves and be wrapped up in the positives of emotional sobriety as opposed to the things that threaten our emotional sobriety.
I was going to say that ratio could use some work for me.
If you look at AA's literature, like the grapevine stories about emotional sobriety, what Bill Wilson was talking about, the 15 insights into emotional sobriety, it really leads us to that sort of, you know, finding our balance. And those, that's the absolute positive side of our existentialism, is that so we are limited. The world will eventually blow up in a supernova, and no one will see my Facebook ever again, and no one will be judging whether I was good or bad, or whether my song sucked or made them want a boogie, right? None of that. It'll all be gone, right? If we can deal with that and get back to the moment, we're going to be okay.
What I see is the real immediate connection to emotional sobriety is having an appropriate and honest relationship with reality. And in psychology, you know, there's a whole approach, as you may know. It was called Bayesian analysis, which was existential analysis, which then was taken by Rollo May, and it was called existential analysis or psychoanalysis. And then Bugenthal, James Bugenthal, both May and Bugenthal were brilliant therapists. They went ahead and elaborated on what this meant for us in terms of doing psychotherapy with people. And what they talked about, Joe, is, which is interesting, is what, you know, the people that you're referring to are also talking about, is that there are certain givens to being a human being. Just part of our conditions. We're finite. That's not going to ever change. The fact that we are in a body that is fragile and susceptible to injury and to illness, that's a given. That's part of life. The fact that every individual has to make choices, regardless of what culture you're in, you have to make a choice. That's another existential given. The fact that we're all going to die. That this life as we know it is going to end. That's a given. So what they looked at, which was very different than what traditional psychoanalytic thinking looked at, they looked at what is our relationship to these givens. How do we relate to those in our lives? Do we operate with a denial of our finiteness and the fact that we're going to die? Existentialists have talked a lot about that in terms of the, you know, the importance of embracing that in some way and having a relationship. It's very interesting that you bring this in today, because you're right. It's such an incredibly important part of emotional sobriety, because it's now extending this idea about having an honest and appropriate relationship to reality, to how do we manage these, or what kind of relationship is a better way to say it, do we have to these givens that you're talking about? And you had a formula there in terms of how to handle them, you know, about the awe and having that awe in our life, that like, wow, look at this. Isn't this amazing? Being curious is what we add all the time. And when you live in respect to some of these things, as we know, when people are given a prognosis that they only have a short time to live, now they take every moment and cherish it. But how come we're not doing that on a daily basis? Because every day we're moving closer to that.
I think it's denial of it.
That's what Becker said, right? In that wonderful book, The Denial of Death, we don't want to look at it. We don't even want to look sometimes at the fact that we have to make choices and what's the best way to do it. Some, you know, I know, you know, in my practice, a lot of people get unbelievably hung up. Should I do this or should I do that? How do I make a choice? What's the best way to make a choice? And, you know, what I see in that one is most people get hung up on making a choice by projecting the outcome. And they think they should make the choice based on what's going to happen. And guess what? You don't know. But we don't like to not know. Oh, another existential given that you taught, our limitations. another existential given. We're not that important. Like Herb Kagan says, I am not the center of the universe. I'm the center of my universe, but not the center of the universe. And like you said, Joe, in terms of our time on this earth, you know, let's take our average now for a male is about 70, what? I think it's dropping in the United States. What is it up in Canada? I think it's around 73 right now here in the States. What's it up in Canada? Do you know?
It's got to be 77, I think. If I'd known, I would have brought my mortality and morbidity tables. I have them.
You do have those. Do you check them on a daily basis?
No, not every day.
All of those things in terms of having them a part of our consciousness. And see, that's the thing, is that as I become more emotionally mature, more differentiated, I'm able to handle those things and what they mean without them causing a lot of anxiety. Because that's the rub. When I'm immature, I don't know what to do with that. I don't know how to convert it into humility. I don't know how to convert it into balance, as you're talking about. I don't know how to convert it into, as Bill said in step 6 and 7, how do I have the best possible attitude towards my life?
This conversation couldn't come at a better time, because I had 3 kind of contacts with mortality over the last week. So a friend of mine from high school died of an overdose. I hadn't heard about it until a few weeks later. But very vivid childhood memories with this guy, and he had a very sad life, and addiction was in his family, and it took his mom, and then he passed away. And then there is a family, the dog, who's been around for, I think she's like 17 years old or something. It's a very old dog, but we love her a lot, and she's been having a lot of health problems, and so we took her to the vet, and, you know, it's we're just kind of managing, you know, her comfort at this point, you know, but you know, we're all acutely aware now that we won't have much time left with her. And then there's a family friend who's been around as long as the dog or longer, you know, my earliest memories, who has cancer and is getting to the end of the road in terms of what are the ways to treat the cancer, and, you know, how is he going to survive? And so we went and visited with him a couple times over the last week. But I realized in my kind of different modes of grief over these 3, you know, individuals, the signal that was being sent to me, besides just, you know, my caring for them, you know, is that the whole show is going to end at some point, not just their show, but my show, that I will be gone too. If they could be gone, I could be gone. And what will that mean? And it's a very shattering notion. And here, the awe, humility, and gratitude, the way I interpret that is, if I'm in recognition of those things, that enables me to really be there with them and to really like be present for that time, and to really kind of like be taking the nourishment I can get from life, you know, rather than getting lost in my fear about, you know, what it might mean when it's when I don't have access to them anymore. Or what might happen to me when I shuffle off this mortal plane. I can't help but think about the state I was in when I first met you. And I wasn't differentiated from anything. I was just a block of cheese. and I had, yeah.
Fused with everything. You were fused with everything in your life. I mean,
yes.
You're right. A block of cheese. I didn't think of you as a block of cheese. I just thought of you as...
It wasn't very tasty.
You just needed some help.
2 things. One is, not only as individuals do we, like, if we're sleepwalking, if we're on impulse, that's a problem for us individually, but also as a society, like this whole tariff thing, like the fact that we need all this stuff from all these other places is a kind of insanity too, right? As opposed to, okay, what could we do without? How could we repurpose some of the stuff we have in our proximity? Like, why do I need grapefruits and oranges when I've got apples and tomatoes, right? You know, they're a source of vitamin C. So we get crazy about, you know, this perpetual consumption is also the sort of a type of immortality project. It's the sort of dark side of existentialism. But something you said, Alan... So we need to be engaged. We need to be sort of regulate ourselves and also be an advocate for others who are going off the deep end. But when you talked about conversion, Alan, that was brilliant to me. I pictured a time where I was getting irritated. I was getting triggered by someone else. I was at an AA assembly and, you know, people, there's issues. We're going to talk about each of the issues, and people feel very strongly on one side or the other side of all of these issues, right? Most people are in the middle and they can't wait till the break. But other people think AA will live and die on whether we publish this pamphlet or whether we don't, whether we change the color of the cover or we don't. And that's great because we have discourse about it. But I found myself being very irritated. And that feeling, I can convert that feeling as opposed to fight that feeling into something more positive and bring me back to, Joe, you need positive regard and curiosity here, right? You know, and if I can get back to that, you know, then awe and gratitude and humility return, right? And that should be my equilibrium, my homeostasis. That's where I want that to be my resting place that I come back to. And this conversion idea is so much better than fighting the energy that I'm filled with. Just convert it into something more positive.
Yeah, well, that's what we're learning to do, right? Is to turn lead into gold. In many ways, there's an alchemy to emotional sobriety that's very powerful. And that's really what we're talking about here, is how to embrace life and all the givens of life and the reality. And that's what we call the reality, right? You know, Byron Katie says, reality is only reality 100% of the time. You know, and most people come up against reality, and I love that line that Tom Rutledge has, one of his nutshells, we get offended by reality. You know, who are we to be offended by reality? See, that's our arrogance. My God, I think reality should only be what I think it should be. I mean, boy, talk about playing God. I mean, you know, and that's a big problem, because that keeps me, when I get into being offended or blaming or complaining or my self-pity over what's happening to me, I lose the opportunity of growing myself another inch or a foot or a yard or whatever happens to be the case, given the challenge that I'm being confronted with and how it relates to the next step in my development.
I miss Tom, too. I heard his voice a couple of times as we were talking.
No, I was very fortunate. I was in therapy with someone that did existential analysis in graduate school. And I was his name is Dr. John Batista was my therapist. And Dr. Batista took over Scott Peck's practice in Connecticut, handed the baton to him. He's a brilliant therapist. I mean, I really respected this man a lot. And it was the old traditional thing. I laid on the couch. He sat over here by my head. I couldn't see him. And I would lay there and we'd talk about things and we would confront these existential givens in life and how I was dealing with them. It was a very, very powerful year of growth. Powerful year of growth. I'll tell you one of the things that I got out of that as we're sharing. So I was talking to him about my dad. You know, you guys know my dad died when I was 11. He was 39. He died from multiple myeloma, horrible death over about a year period of time. He died the day after Christmas in 1963. And I was talking to him about, God, what a great dad he was and stuff like that. And then he made this one comment and he goes, you really idealize your father. And I got so resentful. And I didn't know at the time what was going on. Why was I having such a strong reaction to this comment that I had idealized my dad? And then about 2 months later, I was invited to give a talk at the first joint men's conference for men in recovery on the island of Oahu. I got invited to go over. And so I'm on a plane flying over And, you know, I love to kind of...
I get invited to Buffalo. Like, I don't know how you do this.
So I'm flying and I'm reading this book I just picked up that I really like this guy. I got exposed to him in some of the men's workshops I was going to. His name is Aaron Kipnis. And he wrote a book called Knights, K-N-I-G-H-T-S, Knights Without Armor.
Yeah, wow.
What a great title, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Great.
And as I'm reading it, he starts to talk about Joseph Campbell's work about the hero's journey.
Boom, yeah.
And I all of a sudden connected, my God. My dad, he was on this path thinking that being a hero meant that you suffer in silence.
Yeah.
You don't talk about your pain. You don't talk about the fact that he was facing the end of his life and what that meant for him, what that meant for us as a family. What an opportunity to confront an existential given with the whole family, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So all of a sudden it hit me, shit, I idealized him, but he left me a legacy of not knowing how to talk about my pain and feeling like I have to be self-reliant and that I should suffer this alone and figure it out by myself. And at that moment, the bubble burst and I saw what Dr. Batista was talking about. Is I put him on this pedestal and I could not see where his limitations were, where he wasn't able to show up in his life in a way like confronting this existential given that we're talking about and what it meant. It was just too much for him, or he didn't even know how to have the words to talk about what does it mean to be 39, leaving your wife with four kids at the prime of his life.
Yeah.
Prime of his life. I mean, years before that, he was smoking. I mean, he was doing great in his career. He was an engineer, and he was designing 35 millimeter cameras. I mean, it was like he was just smoking in his life, in great shape. And then all of a sudden, life pulls the rug out from under him.
Yeah.
That's just...
There's no act three, buddy.
It was no act three, but he could not show up for act two.
Yeah.
He did not know how to talk about it. There was just silence. And the silence was deadly. Mm-hmm. It was deadly in my family that we knew we were living with this ominous feeling all the time and nobody was talking about it. And each moment of every day, my safety and my security was eroding. Every day. And we weren't able to talk about it. We weren't able to put any words to it. And I look back, and that would have been so valuable for me to have somebody. Now, I've done that with the chair work. You know, I'll put him in the chair and talk to him. But it would have been so valuable to have some of these conversations with him when he was alive. It would have meant the world to me.
Would it have been valuable at the time to just state the anger that you guys were all feeling, the resentment that the cancer was taking him so young? Yeah.
I hated cancer. I hated what it meant and stuff like that. And yeah, it would have... state the anger, the sadness about it, the grief that was, you know, we were losing him. It's not like he died at the time he died with the cancer. He was dying every day an inch of him was going. Physically, he looked like a concentration camp victim, Patrick, at the end of his life. He was about a 200-pound guy, 5'10", probably had 5% body fat. You know, he was probably into, you know, deadlifting and stuff like that. And he was in great shape. And by the time he died, it looked like he was just let go, released from Auschwitz. There was nothing left. He was like 90 pounds. So we didn't get to talk about any of that. So not only confrontation with death, confrontation of the fragility of the body, our susceptibility to illness and what it means. Confrontation with how do you cope with someone that you love and is going to leave at a certain point in your life and not when you wanted to. Talk about a confrontation with reality. See, these are very important things that no one you know, I'm glad to hear that they're talking about how to handle these things, but no one was talking about that back in the time in 1963. Not that I was aware of, at least.
As it happens, you figured out some ways to talk about it. That became your life's work.
Well, that sure did. That wound became something that informed my life and continues to inform my life. And in fact, Joe, I just came back from Dorset, Vermont, where Bill Wilson was born.
Oh, that's right. I love it there.
Yes. And I did another.
I want to climb that mountain.
I'll tell you, I'll climb it with you when my foot's good.
I had a question just about the curriculum here. Gratitude and humility are very easy to wrap my head around. You know, humility is you're just one part of something larger. And then gratitude, you know, is you're just thankful, you know, for you don't look at the absences, you know, you look at, you know, what's present and you're grateful for it. But where does awe come into play in this kind of framework of emotional sobriety and existentialism?
Awe is the opposite of terror. When we accept that the living with our own finitude couldn't be solved by living forever, that would cause as much dread, you know, that, you know, global climate change and, you know, the economy and inflation, if we were going to live forever, that's a problem too. So awe is the amazement that we actually, the chances of even existing are, you know, so small that here I am, I can breathe. You know, I live in on a planet, the only planet in the solar system that I can exist in, right? You know, that it has oxygen and has water and has people, and I have connection, and, you know, I have people I love, and I have opportunities. That is, that having that awe is so much healthier, I think, for my psychology than, you know, feeling the lack thereof, the finitude of existence, but just the wonder. And I don't even need answers and explanations for all of it. I have awe for the fact that I probably only understand 1% of how my brain works, 1% of how the universe works. We know that there's more dark matter in the universe than what we do understand, right? Like,
I love what I'm seeing unfold in front of me. It's a intense spirituality, but secular.
We remember, right, the first crying of our child, right? You know, those moments in our life that, you know, we'll never forget, right? And storytelling, right? Someone who's aging, just like we know with someone who's new to recovery, bring curiosity and positive regard and say, tell me about your story. Tell me about, you know, your life, right? Tell me about what's gone on for you. And they're sharing that fills them with awe, and it fills me with awe. It's contagious. In fact, we're dependent on each other for it. The speaker and the listener, the message and the receiver.
That's lovely, Joe. You know, not to get too negative, but because it's come up a few times, this thing about the tariffs. I permitted myself to listen to the president talk a little bit yesterday, and he was doing a press briefing in the Oval Office, and he was just talking about the tariffs in context of the deals and, you know, our deals with other countries. And it was all in the language of we're getting screwed, you know what I mean? And so I'm going to exert my, you know, dominance over this country, that country, because we're getting a bad deal and we're getting screwed. Very spite-based kind of way of looking at everything. And God, I mean, if that didn't just cut against everything that we talk about here, you know, spite, you know, spite and being a bully don't really have a place in emotional sobriety.
You know, there is so much good in the worst of us and so much bad in the best of us. Let's try not to judge the rest of us, you know. So
I know I'm being judgy.
Yeah. But yeah. Is it true that we should be more self-reliant, that we shouldn't be we shouldn't live with imbalance in our life. We talk about that too. There is a modicum of truth that he may not even understand behind what he says, in that we need to learn to get along with less. We need to be more self-sufficient in life, you know, socially, spiritually, and materially. All of those things are not incorrect. It's just maybe he's the wrong individual for the job.
Well, all right. I know that he believes that we should get along with less. You know, that's a belief of his.
Look at Joe's balanced perspective on this, right? You see, what it is that he's looking at, you know, can you see some of the value, even if it may be against our values, that this man thinks that he's doing something good. And in his mind, that's where he's coming from. Now, you know, he may be out of touch with reality in terms of the impact it's having on the world and stuff, and we'll see. I don't know. Look, he could be right. He could be wrong. We don't know. It's an experiment. That's what our democracy is, Patrick. It's a big experiment.
What gets me through the day is what little I can affect in our community, you know, in my various fellowships, be that my podcast fellowship, my, you know, AA fellowship, my family, my circle of friends, and then, you know, what I can eke out on the page sometimes, you know, expressing myself creatively. But it's a yes and, not a no but. The no buts don't get me too far.
The emotional sobriety side of world politics or getting through the day or staying sober or dealing with, you know, my feelings, it all comes down to this notion that we do have to be, we are interdependent and we also require self-reliance. It's not a zero-sum game. If I give you this, then I go hungry, right? It's an interdependence and an individuality, right? And you guys have talked about this a lot on this podcast, and I won't go into it. People can just listen to the previous episodes. But we need to avoid, for our own mental health, for our own emotional sobriety, we need to avoid this zero-sum game attitude that we're playing for one victor and one loser, as opposed to we're all in this together.
Thanks so much for coming, Joe. And Alan, it makes me really happy to hear that that there's some podcast listeners that came up to you. And
wonderful, man. It was really cool.
You wonder, when you're talking out into the darkness, is anybody listening? You know, and it's really nice to get some feedback from that, for sure. Yeah.